If you want to bring your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 185. We're going to title this show today Electrotherapy, because our main topic of discussion is going to be electric vehicles, something that I like to talk about. Whether or not Professor Sean is here with us, you know, because he's our, and you can't see my air quotes because this is a podcast, but he's our car expert. So there was an article by Vice that was really interesting. It was well thought out by somebody named Aaron Gordon. And it directly contradicts, through fact, well, as much as fact can be factual, that the U.S. federal government under the Biden administration's idea that 500,000 public electric vehicle chargers is the wrong goal. And he makes a lot of great points. And one of them is that while there is a need to increase the number of public electric vehicle chargers along major highway corridor routes, the goal of putting 500,000 chargers just everywhere doesn't make sense. Because unlike a gas station, most people who own EVs today charge at home. They plug it in and overnight it charges their car and it's ready to run, you know, for 200, 250 miles the next day. And they get home at night and they plug it in again. And most electric vehicle companies, Tesla, General Motors, Ford, Toyota, you name it, as part of the package when you buy an electric vehicle, includes a home electric charger. And as of right now, General Motors is actually installing that, providing that. I mean, reality, it's not. It's built into the price. But the perception that they're trying to give is that they're going to provide that electrical car charger and install it at your residence for free. So there's not a lot of reason to have, you know, to convert gas stations into electrical charging parks. Which is a dilemma in and of itself based upon oil companies and the way jobbers work and the people who actually own the gas stations and all of that from an economic standpoint, because it literally would take gas stations back to being just convenience stores, which has not been the trend for the last 30 years, 35, 40 years. But, you know, the idea is that right now we have 110,000 public chargers, give or take, here in the United States. And that to achieve the goal of the Biden administration of 50% EV sales by 2030, you have to have 500,000. And he's basing this on a New York Times article entitled Biden's Electric Car Plans Hinge on Having Enough Chargers. So, like I said, the author of this article from Vice says they barely mention in the New York Times article at-home chargers, other than to say most drivers today plug in their electric cars at home and only occasionally use public car station or charging stations. It's only if you need to go long distance, longer than, you know, half of what your electric car charge would be, where you would need to use a public car station, which in today's economy and today's, in today's social climate with COVID, and I'm not afraid to say it, unlike all the YouTubers who don't want their videos banned because YouTube and decides that the word COVID is something to ban. But because of COVID, you're not seeing people taking, you're seeing a dichotomy of people. You're seeing about 50% people having many more staycations And the other 50% are so tired of being cooped up that they're going places, and they are driving long distances.
But you know, well, finish your thought and then come to me.
But because of that, you know, we're not seeing probably people who have electric vehicles today. It's kind of like back in the 50s, 40s and 50s, late 40s, when everybody came back from World War II and everybody was a one car family. And so now when people are adding an EV, their other car in their two car family, when women became part of the workforce and you actually started to see commuting where people weren't living, they were living in suburbs and commuting into jobs in the city. So there was a need for a second car. You're seeing that second car be the larger SUV. Cause think about it. American car companies. Well, one, America's not like Europe. It is huge. We don't have a private passenger rail service, but we do have plenty of private passenger airlines, which is a total another story today. But you have a lot, you know, an incredibly hugely built out diverse public highway system. So people want comfort if they're going to travel long distances. They'll put up with small vehicles and things like that, you know, if you're just commuting back and forth, because they want fuel economy. It's all about, you know, the dollars. But when you're traveling, they're willing to spend money. And so a lot of those second gas vehicles that people would take long trips on are SUVs and vans. And, you know, the American car companies reflect that, with companies like Ford only making the Ford Mustang as a passenger vehicle or a car. Everything else they make are crossovers, SUVs, vans, or pickup trucks. And others are following suit. You know, the even Japanese car companies whose main market happens to be the United States, they've discontinued their smaller cars. The Toyota Yaris was discontinued in 2020. That was the worldwide number one vehicle sold, passenger car sold, for almost, I don't know, back in the 2000s when they introduced it. Why? Because got great gas mileage. It was small. It fit everywhere. Because of its size and range and capability, it worked in almost every environment they sold it in, whether it was Europe, the United States, Asia, whatever. But even they are realizing that people are not wanting those little cars as much, so they're not going to produce that little car. Mazda's done the same thing. Everybody's moving to bigger vehicles. And if you look at the electric EV market, with the exception of Ford and the F-150 Lightning, that market is pretty much owned today by Tesla. They're the number one EV maker because that's all they make. They don't make anything else. And they've aggressively gone after the market in a way that I thought was rather smart, which is build cachet around a luxury vehicle, sell that luxury vehicle initially to people who can afford to pay a lot of money for a luxury vehicle. And then as time goes on, we start introducing other models. And eventually they got to the Tesla Model 3, which is not a compact car by any size. It's a four-door passenger vehicle, much like what the Nissan Altima is or was. I don't know if they're still making the Nissan Altima. But, you know, they got it down to where it's what I would call a semi-affordable price. But somewhere in that median price range where there's a lot larger market than the folks who were buying the Model S's and the Model X and, you know, all the luxury versions of those vehicles. Any comment?
I want to go back to home chargers.
Yeah.
For a moment. Because it just occurred to me that there's no gas equivalent of a home charger. And the point that I'm making there is we're currently funding our roads through gas taxes. And I don't know how you would tax a home charger specifically for road infrastructure.
Exactly.
I don't know.
Well,
how
I don't
you
know
do
how
that.
They even tax public chargers because.
Well, and then there's that. You because know. Quite frankly, if we're spending tax dollars to build them, they should be free.
Yes, absolutely. But that's not the case of how the Biden administration wants to roll it out.
Because, well, of course, like, they want to spend our money and then take even more of it.
Like,
that's
like today,
how they
a lot
work.
Of the public chargers. So this article from Vice is actually really, really comprehensive because he not only does he address the home charger issue, because he also, you know, the New York Times was making the claim that, well, people who have EVs who live in rental properties or whatever, they won't have access to home chargers. And I think that's kind of ridiculous because he's like, well, maybe the incentive should be a tax rebate for people who own rental properties like apartments and condos and things like that, and to get them to install vehicle chargers in their, you know, in every space in their parking lot. Because eventually that's going to have to be the case. Because the other thing is the cost that you pull electricity off on your home charger is less than half than what you pay for when you go to a public charger. And, you know, there's these public charger networks. They're all run by, you know, Tesla has their network. And depending on what model of Tesla you get lifetime freebies to charge at those. But, like, if you're in the Model 3 area, you pay, you give them a credit card, essentially, and they charge you for what you use. When you go use their things, kind of like, you know, the way the toll road sensors in your car is, you know, it's associated with when you drive under the fast pass and it lets you go through without having to stop. But
correct me if I'm wrong, though, they're not taking any taxes out of that. That's
no,
straight Tesla profit.
That is correct. As far as I know. I mean, there's probably some corporate income taxes on that income.
Oh, you're right.
There's no gas tax or road tax for that. And so that, you know, that becomes the issue of, again, great technology. The federal government is pushing it, and they're not telling, well, they're not providing any way or even it's the. It's the chicken before the egg and the. Or the cart before the horse type concept. We want this to happen because there's this concept that it is green to drive an electric vehicle.
I'm not convinced of that
well,
either.
And that's the other part of this article from Vice that I thought about. So, in here, and I'm quoting this article from Vice, it says, surveys and studies reportedly show the vast majority of EV charging is done at home, either in a driveway or garage. Consumer Reports found that owners of EVs who can charge at home and have a car with a range of about 250 miles can do 92% of charging at home, visiting public chargers on an average of just 6 times a year. In fact, this is one of the key benefits of EV ownership. Earlier this year, AutoNation CEO Mike Jackson said on CNNBC, here's what EV owners like. They buy an electric car and they tell us, you know what's great? I never have to go to a gas station again. So
never have to pay for your roads again either, too, apparently.
Correct. Well, and that's it. Right now, there's, you know, and don't get me wrong, states are working on ideas like in Ohio. You pay more money for licensing, but it is not the equivalent of what you would pay over the lifetime of a car.
Yeah.
You know, your registration fee every year is, I think it's double. So Ohio has flat registration fees. Some states do it by luxury tax, like state of Kentucky. You buy a new vehicle and you actually have to finance the luxury tax in because it's enough that it's like several thousand dollars to register your vehicle. Because they're taking all that money up front as opposed to getting it, you know, $100 or $200 from you every year for the life of the vehicle, which I kind of think the flat way of doing it is again, they call it a fee. It is a tax. Anytime the government charges you to do something, it's a tax. But so they're doubling the cost of electric vehicle registrations, which is annualized here in Ohio. And so they're using that to offset the money you would pay. But the thing is the money you would pay in gas tax typically would still be greater than that $100. So they're relying on all the gas cars buying gasoline to pay for those who have electric vehicles right now.
And that's great if you're
an electric vehicle
early adopter until whatever that percentage of market share is that it no longer works and our roads fall apart even worse than they are already.
Yeah. Well, and then on top of that, this idea that if we install a whole bunch more public chargers, it's going to increase the adoption of EV car owners.
Say that again?
So the whole premise of installing, you know, the federal government providing money in this infrastructure bill that we keep talking about is based upon the fact, which has not been proven, that by providing more infrastructure, we're going to drive more EV adoption.
Oh, yeah. No, that's... First of all, you have to have the disposable income to purchase the vehicle, which currently Americans don't have.
Yes.
I mean, our federal government is continuing to print money like the Weimar Republic, as if history hasn't already taught that lesson at least once or twice. The price of the car is going to skyrocket as well.
Well, that's the issue. So, like, right now, EVs not only are hard to get because we're looking at semiconductor shortages into March of 2022 at this point. I have a feeling...
But then there's that issue, because frankly...
There's the lithium issues in building the batteries. The fact that your car is essentially like a laptop, but a laptop's... You know, there are two types of people in the technology world. There are the people like me who buy high-end stuff and then they keep it for years and years and years and they take good care of it, which is another issue. The maintenance, people don't understand the maintenance of an electric car because they think of it like their cell phone. You know, I plug my cell phone in every night to keep it charged, but what does that really do to the battery over time? But cell phones are a commodity item, and let me go back to my statement. So there's people like me who buy high-end, high-quality stuff, and they use them for a long, long time. Then there's the other people who buy super, super low-end. You know, they wait till Black Friday when and they buy the lowest common denominator Windows laptop, you know, with 4 gig of RAM and 64 or 128 gig SSD in it by today's standards, and they pay $200 for it, and they use it for 2 years, and at the end of that 2 years, it is almost worthless because it can't run, and then they wait for Black Friday, and they do the same thing again. And so those people, it doesn't matter if the battery goes bad in their laptop because they know that in a set amount of time, they're going to do that. Cars, particularly electric vehicles, are so expensive that you're not going to do that. You know, today, because we've been driving petrol or gasoline cars since the turn of the 20th century, there are, I'm going to do my Carl Sagan impression, billions and billions of cars, used cars, cars in the junkyard, cars that, some of my favorite videos on YouTube are the Will It Drive, where these guys go out and they get cars to run and they drive them around that have been sitting for 30 or 40 years that, you know, other people thought there's no way it'll ever work, so it's not valuable to me. So, but there's lots of vehicles like that are available and are still roadworthy. And there's nothing like that in electric vehicles. And just by the nature of the way electric vehicles work today with current lithium battery cells, yes and no.
But I think that the runway for that is too long to benefit in the short run, which is what I think Biden is kind of relying on.
Well, he's he's made a promise that has nothing basis that's based in reality.
Yeah.
You know, and even to say something like at 2030, well, it's 2021 now. By the time 2030 rolls around in 9 years, Biden is so old, he probably will be dust. He's already, he's mud right now. Just wet dust. So he's never likely going to see that. And even if he did, he's not, the end of his presidential term and influence in that is long, is still another presidential term before that date. We're never going to see 50% EV ownership by then. There's just not enough EV vehicle manufacturers out there. And there's other things.
But then you get the component availability issue on top of that.
Well, you got that, which I really think, so, you know, we talk about the supply chain, because it's not just chips. It's the substrate to build the chips and all this, you know, it's a huge supply chain that we're having raw material to component availability issues on. And there's a backlog. If you drive by the Kentucky Raceway on I-71 heading towards Louisville, the Ford F-150 plant in Louisville, well, Ford F-Series truck plant in Louisville uses the Kentucky Raceway's parking lots to put excess inventory in while they're waiting to distribute it. Well, their parking lots are completely full. It's amazing as you drive by because there's thousands of Ford trucks, which is the number one selling truck in the world. Why are they sitting there? Well, it's because they can't get chips to put in there to make the fuel economy meet federal regulations. General Motors had such a problem earlier this year that they decided to release two vehicles that actually wouldn't even meet regulations just so that they weren't paying the inventory tax, because they needed to ship these vehicles. I hate to be one of the people who bought them. Now, if you know, the one thing you got to understand about pickup trucks is that you have three consumer segments. You have the agricultural segment, you have the industrial segment who buys fleets of trucks, you know, construction companies and civil engineering firms and, you know, all that. And then you have consumers, which is by far the smallest part of it. But even in the United States, consumers consume a lot of pickup trucks because there are a lot of guys who will never haul anything in their truck, but they want a vehicle that big. And part of that is there is an amount of safety having that much steel around you. But that being said, and then the cost of vehicles, whether they're gas or electric, are astronomical right now. You know, so people aren't buying new vehicles. And also, the United States, with our car culture, the used vehicle market here is huge. It's not like, I mean, I've been to the UK where they have a used vehicle market, but it is nothing like it is here. And that being said, it's also nothing like the used vehicle markets that you get in, like, North Africa, because nobody can afford to buy a new vehicle, so used vehicles are the only thing. And that's part of why the United States used vehicle market is so huge, is because we have more vehicles that are in good shape that they pay to ship overseas to, like, Northern Africa, the Middle East. That's also why you see so many Taliban videos where they're driving Toyotas and Fords and Chevys. But so EV ownership, you know, EVs, somebody's going to have to come down to the point where there's a wide range of vehicles in the EV market that, because right now the cheapest EV vehicles are in this mid-tier area. You know, people who are wanting to pay anywhere between $30,000 and $50,000 for a vehicle. And that's still not it's bigger than the people who are wanting to pay $100,000 plus for a vehicle, but it's still not a huge part of the market. They're going to have to get them to where electric vehicles, particularly with all the trade-offs that you have with them, like battery lifespan, you know, the fact that pretty much right now, if you total an electric vehicle, or if you get in a wreck with an electric vehicle, even if it's just a fender bender, the insurance rates on it are high, because without parts availability, which is another huge issue. They're totaling those vehicles. And then on top of all that, you have the electric vehicles are prone for the whole right to repair issue. And cars typically, at least in American culture, have always been something that you maintained yourself. And so there's lots of people with the skills.
That's becoming less and less so.
It is, but it's not because the vehicle makers are making it. I mean, in 1980, around 78 to 1980, they car makers with the when they started putting computers to control them made vehicle maintenance harder to do. But it's never been one of those things where like the car makers are intentionally trying to keep people from maintaining their own vehicles. You know, it was more of, well, we added a component and didn't really think it through. That's also why in the United States, there's a huge...
I would buy that if once that it was exposed, they would have done away with that. They didn't. They doubled down on it.
Well, no. The reason they doubled down on it is the U.S. federal government got involved with the EPA. Oh. And so the only way to make sure that you could meet the EPA standards for your vehicle was... And don't get me wrong. Where there is a will, there is a way. And people have learned to disable the powertrain control module and the body control module and you know, and even the entertainment system computers that are in cars. But there still is a tradition of fixing your own vehicle if you want to, as opposed to a lot of like what John Deere has been, particularly in the agricultural community, it has always been, fix your own frickin' farm equipment. And you have John Deere who's going like, well, you don't really own your tractor that you bought. You got to call us if you make a change. Otherwise, we're going to void the warranty on your vehicle. And it's for stupid stuff. Like, you want to do your own oil change, you know? And so John Deere's come under a lot of scrutiny because of that. But even on the automobile market, it's routine. People might not do engine repairs, but they will do their own oil changes, you know?
My Uncle Bob used to do that. He doesn't do it anymore.
I knew him. Because I've had so many bad experiences at a lot of the oil changing places over the years. Like, my sister-in-law had a beautiful white Toyota Corolla, and she took it to Walmart and they didn't put the oil plug in, and so they filled it up with oil, but because it was standing over the drain where they drain oil, they poured I don't know how many new quarts of oil down in that drain and then gave her the keys when she drove off, and about 15-20 miles later the engine locked up. And they're not the only people. I had a guy who got out of working at Walmart service at once, who worked for me in the Air Force, and he said that, you know, he was the supervisor too, and he's like, I would come in and I would find, you know, they had wedged a pry bar in the engine trying to get the oil filter off, you know, and the problem is that's a totally other known issue about a lot of these, you know, Jiffy Lubes, and these guys are not mechanically inclined and they've had very little formal training, but that's besides the point of what we're talking about here. But going back to the article, even more interesting is that is the statement by the author is that third, relying on fast charging infrastructure undermines the main goal of EVs, which is environmental sustainability. Fast chargers are incredibly energy intensive. As electric vehicle charging company EVgo explained in a white paper, the energy consumption of one DCFC station with four 50 kilowatt chargers in use 35% of the time uses as much energy per year as it would take to power 35 single family homes. So that, you know, it goes back to my statement before. How is this better? How is this more green? And they even go on to say that 450 kilowatt chargers at the same utilization rate would require the power of 100 homes, and then the 350 kilowatt fast chargers would equate to about 230 homes. So that's where we get this issue of, as we get into EV adoption, if we put 500,000 fast chargers out there, the energy consumption is going to be greater than our grid is currently set to handle.
But that's another infrastructure project that should have been managed years, if not decades ago. I mean, we've been struggling with power consumption issues for a while, where demand exceeds supply.
Well, and that's largely the problem with that. And now, I love solar and wind and water power, but you know, when we talk about energy independence from a government standpoint, they're talking about either state energy independence or federal, you know, country energy independence. The reality of it is we need to tackle energy independence from a personal point of view. So as we build new construction,
we can't do that because the government steps in the way and stops you.
That's right. Because why do they stop us? Because companies like Duke Energy, you know, they come in and they have a lobbying group and they pay off, you know, political candidates who come in and make sure that legislation in the individual's favor is never taken care of. And that's the same thing that's going on with this electric vehicle charging thing. Companies like EVgo, who, by the way, have like a 1-star satisfaction rating from consumers, because people go to use their public chargers and they don't work. They're broken all the time, you know, which tells me that they have a service and maintenance issue problem, which either means that the equipment they're buying is cheap Chinese junk, which is likely the case, and then they have nobody to go out and maintain it, you know, particularly as you spread out. Tesla's not so much in that case, but they, you know, they still, I'm fairly certain Tesla's lobbying the government that, because it's in their favor to have 500,000 chargers put in place. Even if they get 10% of those, here's what I think is going to happen. We'll never get to 500,000, but they might get a couple hundred thousand installed, and they're going to find that the utilization rates on them are like 1%. And so what happens when that happens? Well, the cost of maintaining it is probably greater than the cost or, you know, what they're making in profit. And so all of these energy companies or, you know, charging companies are going to go out and they're going to go, do we really need to have these 6 all in, you know, within a mile or 2 miles or 5 miles or 10 miles, whatever it is, of each other? How many of these can we eliminate?
Because that's how business works.
Exactly. Well, again, it goes back to Keynesian economics and supply and demand. And right now, there's no demand. The government is stepping in to create supply, thinking that it will create demand, but that's never been the case.
No, anybody who's taken a basic economics class will tell you that the way to do that is to let demand slightly exceed supply to the point where it becomes sustainable, and then you can increase supply in order to meet the demand and drive price down.
Yes.
That's how technology works. That's how economics works.
The other issue with this right now is that by artificially creating supply prior to having demand, I mean, because they're talking about the actual numbers were like these public chargers have 35% utilization. Okay.
I'm going to take the under.
I would be, you know, when those chargers get 75% utilization, then I can see maybe, hey, we may need to look at the demand situation or supply situation for this, because demand is at 3/4 of
of current capacity.
Yeah.
That's that there's a logical business flow there.
Yeah.
The problem is government doesn't do business.
No, because
they destroy business. It's what they do.
Yeah. But it's going to artificially increase because they're providing supply now where there's no demand. So it means we're buying it at the most expensive it's going to be purchased at. And then we're going to have to pay that off over time. And, you know, the thing about technology,
it's just not a good investment.
It is not a good investment.
And that's the thing that irks me about this infrastructure bill to begin with. It's loaded with crap like that. You can't just stop with EV chargers. It's the whole fracking bill.
Oh, absolutely. It is. It is. But I wanted to bring this up because, you know, this is one of those issues with electric vehicles that, you know, people are just starting to think through. And I'm not talking about government officials because they have no clue. They, you know, it's kind of like every time they call Mark Zuckerberg and you know, the CEO of Google and all them in front of Congress, and they start asking these fundamental questions about technology that everybody else, you know.
What is the Google anyway?
Yeah.
Tell me, what is the Google?
Yep. So.
And we wonder.
So.
How we're, where we're at.
I want to segue to another interesting article that was kind of hilarious about electronic vehicles. But basically, this guy who is a thief figured out a way to scam Tesla. And
I love it already.
Because what happens is there's a gap in the period where I want to explain this right, so let me find the article real quick. So also by the same author, Aaron Gordon, and Vice Magazine. So there was this mystery of a burnt Tesla in the middle of a frozen lake. And in 2019, a burned out carcass of a Tesla Model X was found on a frozen lake in Vermont. Prosecutors allege it was part of an unsophisticated theft scheme gone wrong. So basically what happens is because Tesla has done a non-traditional, and I do like the model. It's actually a model much more similar to the way you buy cars over, you know, in Europe. But because of the fact that they're not using the traditional dealer model, this unsophisticated group of, and it wasn't even a group, this unsophisticated guy figured out that when you buy the car online, you'd put like $2,500 down at the time of purchase, and then you provided bank account details for an automated clearinghouse transfer, an ACH transfer from your bank account. And then the car customer goes to the Tesla store to pick up the car, or it's delivered to them at their residence. So at that time when it's delivered, the customer gets a manufacturer certificate of origin, which allows you to then register the car under your name with the DMV, get a title and license plates and everything. So, but what this guy did is he noticed that you could pick up the car from the store before the actual ACH transfer occurred. So, he would put his $2,500 down, he'd go pick up his car, and then it would be 15, 20, 30 days before Tesla was notified by the bank that there was insufficient funds for the ACH transfer to happen. And so you could be long gone with the vehicle, have it registered and titled and everything before. So this guy, and here's where he was kind of stupid. So he bought a Model 3 for $58,200 in September of 2018. He used his real driver's license and address and bank account. And he paid the $2,500 down payment, leaving $55,000 owed. On October 31st, he emailed Tesla to confirm he had received the car. In November, Tesla tried to... So, again, more than 30 days, yeah. Tesla tried to bill him for the car, and it was declined for insufficient funds. So, in December, Gonzalez sold that car to a used car dealership for $42,500. And he repeated this process four more times with Model X's, so the SUVs. But...
Did he continue to use his real name? No, he
roped friends and relatives in to buy the cars from the Tesla before transferring the cars, and then transfer the cars to his name after delivery. And in some cases, he even made up fake bank account numbers to get it through. So... what ended up happening is he didn't get one of the manufacturer's certificates with one of the cars before they figured it out. And so he couldn't register the car or anything. So he took the car, parked a Model X out on the ice in Vermont on a lake, and set it afire. And he tried to make an insurance claim. But because it wasn't titled and in his name... the insurance company denied it, and that's when they caught him.
Wow. I mean, how greedy do you have to be to... Wow.
But, you know, what's kind of interesting about that, because this article, I think Sean would have chuckled at.
Yeah, he would have. He would have liked this one.
Yeah, because, you know, as smart as Tesla's business model is, they didn't cover everything.
Well, I tend to think of Elon as a Tony Stark.
He is. Well, you got to remember,
he's more about the technology than he is the actual business.
Yeah,
now,
but
he's not a complete buffoon.
No, but what did we go back to before, though? So their model is set up for people who have large amounts of liquid assets available, as opposed to people who are going to typically buy a car. I know a lot of people who, if they, and I'm talking people who have perfect credit ratings and are very responsible, but they're going to borrow. You're going to buy a $60,000 car, they're going to get a bank loan for that. They don't have the money to do an ACH transfer out of their bank account. Now, people who buy Model X's and Model S's, and, you know, more of them are not going to be financing a Tesla. Plus, my curiosity is, I wish we had somebody who was a banking expert, worked for a bank, like a loan officer or something, to understand if they, you know, what the risks are or what the banks perceive as risk in getting a loan for, like, a Tesla or another electric vehicle. Because, I mean... the reality of it is right now, they're not proven to, well, we know battery life is an issue, that after about 10 years, you either got to replace the batteries or whatever. But also, we have no idea at the moment how long any of these parts are going to last. I mean, they're Chinese made.
Well, not only that, but taking climate conditions.
Exactly. Well, we know that electric vehicles... a lot of people in the Northeast who've bought electric vehicles, you get in the winters there and they go, well, I'm not getting the range I was supposed to. My batteries must be bad. Well, no, they have battery heaters to keep the batteries from freezing and then really doing damage to the battery. But the heater runs off the battery, which then sucks more current than what's available, you know, or than what you're... it's supposed to be set aside for charging. Well, for EV range.
Right.
Now, my other question is, it's like super hot climates. Where do EVs fall in? How does the air conditioner work? Because it's not like that you have a closed-loop air conditioning system that runs off of, you know, the motor as it's running, which even in gas engines causes fuel economy, particularly the older you go. The newer ones, they've kind of got it down. But, you know, how does that work? I'm sure it runs off the, you know, even if it's a traditional air conditioning compressor, there has to be an extra electric motor that's got to spin that compressor to make it work, just like an air conditioner in your house would work. So what does that do to range? You know, when you get out into New Mexico and Southern California and Arizona and places where, you know, it stays warm most of the year. Yeah, your heaters never come on, which might affect the length of the battery's life, but you're going to be using all that extra energy that could be given to range, you know. It's an interesting conundrum, and, you know, I hate the guy who made up the saying, you know, I hope you wish you to live in interesting times, but it is interesting times, you know, for multiple reasons. And, you know, the other funny thing about cars in the United States is, again, the United States is vast compared to most other countries. And our population, while not equally spread out, is spread out across our entire country. So we don't have a huge public transportation infrastructure.
And we shouldn't.
No, exactly, for that same reason. Exactly.
It would be inefficient for us to do that.
Yeah. Well, it's just like the inefficiency of trying to put out 500,000 EV chargers at any given time.
Well, that's the point. I mean, government gets this idea that this is the way to go, and they don't think it through. They think, oh, well, this is good enough for Europe. Why didn't this work for us? Well, we're a totally different country.
Yeah.
They don't take that into account. They never have. Well, they never will. That's how government works. Yeah. Or doesn't work.
Doesn't work. Yeah. So I do want to loop back to considering that this article came from Looper. To Star Trek Day last week. So one of the things that they have an article that came out, and some of it I agree with. The biggest mistakes Star Trek Strange New Worlds should avoid. And so, number one, you and I talked about this. Neglecting the supporting cast.
Yes.
I totally agree with this. You know, the fact that you can hardly name anybody but Burnham and
Saru.
Yeah. Kayla Detmer. And that's only because they've said her name like 5 or 6 times. Most people won't be able to name her.
Well, my only reason for knowing her name is the parallels between her and any character on Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you get Airlock, that's a big deal.
Well, no, that's Arium. See? Case in point. Case in point. But, you know, particularly, they cannot neglect the supporting cast if they're bringing in, like M'Benga and Uhura, as, you know, younger iterations of themselves.
It would be foolish to bring those characters on board and not use them.
Correct. And because of the episodic nature that Strange New Worlds is supposed to, that was part of the reason you ended up having such a good ensemble cast in TOS. Is because, yeah, Chekhov might not be, he might be bridge decoration in 4 episodes, but every 5th episode he was a main character. Same with Sulu. The only guys who were like bridge decorations were the red shirts, other than Scotty and Uhura. Some of them might have gotten, well, they did name a couple of the security chiefs a couple of times in TOS, I think.
Yeah, but most of them were higher ranked than the ones that go down on the away teams.
Exactly. Now, this one, I don't know that I totally agree with. So the second one they put out there was being too precious about canon. And
yeah, I totally disagree with that.
I disagree with that because...
Part of why this show is going to be as good as it's going to be...
And appealing because of canon. It's going to follow canon.
It's going to appeal to canon.
Yep. We don't want retcons. We don't want, you know...
Well, which goes back to...
What makes the best Star Wars movies? It's Rogue One, Han Solo story. Why? It's bookended by canon on both sides. Both of them are.
And they respect
yeah.
the beginning and end points.
Yep.
Which well, is why
and
like,
even what makes
where's the, Dr. Boyce?
Yeah.
Where's Tyler at?
Well, and you know,
Newman Colt.
Yeah, and you know, those all may come back, and
they may, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
So long as those kinds of things are addressed.
Yeah.
At some point, and I think they would be.
I think they will be. You know, it. The other one that I don't totally agree with is leaning too hard on nostalgia, and they in their example. They show Rainn Wilson as Harry Mudd from Discovery,
mm-hmm.
who I think should have his own show.
He should. I mean,
yeah.
I posted that article. That
better. It would be better than the Section 31, and it would be great because it would be bookended by canon, but it would give you the perspective of somebody not in Starfleet. You know, and the perspective that Starfleet is meddlers and all this other. I mean.
Well, they kind of do that with Deep Space Nine with the Bajorans, but they're not normal people.
No.
Whereas a Harry Mudd character would be more
well, he's somebody who normal. Yeah, he's somebody who lives outside the norms of Federation society, which is makes it appealing.
Yeah.
You know. And it is my understanding that Harry Mudd is going to be yeah, and it's my understanding that he might be making some appearances in Strange New Worlds as well. They talked about that early
that.
On.
Yeah, I could see that.
So, now, this one I do agree with, which is playing it too safe politically. But, that being said, it needs to address issues like TOS did, as opposed to, I'm going to have an LGBTQ+ character on here because every show needs an LGBTQ+ character on it.
Well, not only that, but I think TOS did things with a certain amount of subtlety. I mean, when they brought out the hammer, they brought out the hammer.
Yeah.
Every show does that.
Correct, but again, we talked about this last time. It needs to be done in a subtle way. You need to build the analogs to show, you know, hey, we're addressing this issue that is really in society today, but we're going to just, you know, provide an intelligent way to not only bring the issue up, but then, you know, kind of provide some resolution or a solution to solve it. You know, because some of the best episodes of TOS are that way, like the Charons, where, you know, the guy was white and black and the other guy was black and white, you know. And they're looking at him and going, well, I don't see the difference. That made sense.
Yeah.
But... you know, let's make the show diverse, or the cast, and I'm air quoting again, diverse, because we're going to make sure we have our quota of X, Y, and Z, you know.
Well,
and it's fine to do that.
You'll never be able to achieve infinite diversity and infinite combinations, because the word is infinite for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Good Star Trek reference.
Thank you.
This one I agree with, which is perpetuating the cynical take on Starfleet, which has happened since TNG. We talk about this all the time. You know, that there's this cadre of bad Starfleet officers. You know, one of the things about Star Trek that was really good is that humanity's future was better.
Yeah.
You know, and we've gotten a lot of that where it hasn't been.
You know, I'm still willing to see a futuristic world where they still don't get government right.
Yeah.
But come on now. I mean, this is supposed to be an optimistic vision of the future. Let's be optimistic for a change.
Yep. Yep. And I agree with this one as well, which is the abuse of the magic reset button.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Well, and again, that goes back to your point about the new Star Wars films that work. They respect the canon. You have a beginning point and an end point, which must be respected. If you reset it and retcon everything,
yeah, well,
you're destroying.
They gave a great example of this too, though. So they use Voyager. So Voyager is stuck out in the Delta Quadrant, thousands of light years from home. They instead of having a episodic nature, you know, they have a serialization or serial storyline. So the ship, nowhere near Federation Starbase, whatever, they undergo damage. The Borg and the Vidians, I mean, all kinds of different races do horrible damage to the ship, and the next episode the ship is magically repaired. I mean, that's one of those things I always talk about in continuity. It breaks the suspension of disbelief. Battlestar Galactica, serialized show. If the Battlestar got majorly damaged, it was...
That was a consequence that was dealt with in the next episode.
Correct.
Otherwise,
correct.
You would lose that realism aspect of what made the show so appealing.
Yep. And now one of them...
And that's what bugs me about Lower Decks. Because here you have an opportunity to really demonstrate that. And we still hit the magic reset button.
We do.
Pretty much every episode, which is fine, because it works for a comedy. But if we were to ever
You missed Matt's air quotes.
You miss an opportunity to really, really delve into what it would be like to be an ensign or a junior lieutenant on one of these ships.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the problem with the Lower Decks is they've dealt with it in... They actually have made fun of it.
Yeah.
The, you know, the whole shacks, you know, that if you're dead, you're not really dead concept. You know, so they have shacks killed in the end of season one. In the beginning of season two, they bring in the new security chief. And then all of a sudden, Shax is walking around the ship again, and they, you know, they actually have the characters talking about it, and I think it's fun, but that, you know, that's another good example of the magic reset button. And instead of addressing it, that's one of those that I think in Lower Decks, it's, again, you can kind of get away with it, but it should be addressed in the other shows.
Yeah, no. So like, if this show were really about the bridge crew, they'd have to address it.
Yeah.
Whereas with it being Lower Decks, it's, well, they just don't need to know.
Yeah.
And that's how that's addressed, and you hit the magic reset button, and off you go.
So the next one is overdeveloping Spock.
Agreed.
I do agree with that. They can't, because you're bookended, you know, we have Discovery on one side.
It's bad enough that we got adopted sister Burnham, who we'd never heard of before. I mean, you can do that with Cybok. You can do that once.
Yeah, we've done it twice.
We've done it at least twice. And you can't do it.
Well, you find out that Sarek was
rather
prolific.
Prolific, yes.
Yep.
That's the word.
And then lastly, well, they have two. One of them, I don't even know why it's on here. The last one they have is reusing the original Star Trek theme music. They haven't done that ever. Now, they've paid homage in other themes with pieces of it, like the original Alexander Courage, you know, bum, 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 bum. I think that's appropriate. I think you can use that because it provides continuity and ties it together. But
you should, because it's the Enterprise.
It is.
You do that on any other show, then you run some questions. But I have no problems with that, with it being on the Enterprise.
Yeah, yeah. But the other one was losing the camp, and I guess
are they advocating for losing the camp?
Well, what did it?
Or emphasizing it.
Well, what I think they're trying to talk about is that Star Trek, the new shows, there's no
levity.
Exactly. There's no levity. There's no... The original TOS, there were some
Lower Decks aside.
Yeah, Lower Decks aside. You know, Trouble with Tribbles. You know, the end of the episode, there's some humorous moments. And that's some of the best Trek moments was at the end of the episodes, you know, when they're leaving, you know, the planet that this adventure took place on. And Bones and Spock are, verbally jabbing at each other, you know, and William Shatner has a weird smirk on his face because it's funny. It's the way people really are. Yeah. You know, they take a serious situation and sometimes they'll joke about the, you know, some of the things that happened because, you know, either how somebody reacted or acted or whatever, because it does become humorous because it's humor from the spectacle of absurdity. I can't believe we had to put up with this. You know,
when it's also a stress relief.
Correct.
You know, those super serious episodes where you're dealing with heavy excrement.
Yeah.
Then you have to have those moments.
Which there are almost none of those in Picard or Discovery. And I think that
Picard takes itself too seriously.
Yeah.
Discovery does too.
That just drives the... It makes the shows seem much darker than they should be. I mean... Okay. They should have joked about, I can't believe a Kelpian crybaby was the one who destroyed dilithium.
Yeah,
you know.
Destroyed our entire civilization.
So. Oh, and the other one, and I kind of agree with this, is not to have a TVMA rating.
I agree with that too. This one should be more wholesome.
Yes. Well, and so their argument, and I agree with the argument, is that if we're going to have five different Star Trek shows, then let's have the shows all, instead of all being the same thing with just different characters, let's have them all try to target a different part of the demographic in the Star Trek audience.
Agreed. Because I don't think any of the other new Treks have really tried to reach out to the original set of fans.
Correct. I agree. So, I'm going to leave it there. We've been talking for over an hour.
Nice.
And we want to hear... Well, first of all, we want to thank everybody who listens to us. We would really appreciate your feedback. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what you think. If we actually hear back from somebody, there might be some swagging involved. But we got to hear back from you. So leave us some feedback at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. Or visit our website at www.gizmosapiens.com and leave a post or a comment on the episode post. So see you on the digital flip side.
Listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.